Hello and welcome to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host for today. My name is Carl Rzechowski, and we have a packed show today, so I'm going to get right to it. Today's interview is with Jody Castrocano, editor of the book Animal Subjects, and Lauren has filled this hour to the brim with an interview with her. It's excellent, and we're going to check it out in just a minute. But before that, I wanted to make two very important announcements. We got a message from ARC2 today to please note that the benefit concert and auction for the horses of the RR Horse Refuge located in Alexandria, Ontario is taking place tonight. So please come out and support this worthy cause to raise money for a worthy rescue. By attending, you will help save the lives of 165 animals who need water. All funds go to build a well to provide water for them. It's hosted by ARC2 and Students Against Climate Change. It's happening tonight, January 20th, 2009 at 7 p.m. The location is the supermarket at 268 Augusta Avenue in Kensington Market, just south of College. Tickets are available at the door for $10. There's five artists and bands that'll be performing, and other possibility of other musical performers, plus a comedian. Doors open at 6:45 p.m., and once again, it's at 268 Augusta Avenue in Kensington Market, and the venue is called The Supermarket. Starts at 7, definitely go check it out. And the second announcement before we get to the interview. We don't usually announce this information, but we got a special message from someone and decided that we would pass it along. There's a $1,000 reward being offered for a dog named Penny, who is still missing. The Toronto-wide search, and we were updated on January 17th, 2009. Penny was last seen December 7th at the High Park Avenue, Bloor Street West area. She's a 35-pound spayed female, white and apricot mixed breed. Her microchip number is 982-009-105-462-418, and her Toronto ID is D08111774, and she was possibly picked up by someone. If you have any information, please contact Alana Cowell. Her number is 416-762-2686 or 416-453-3232, and you can check out more information about Penny at findpenny.blogspot.com. That's findpenny.blogspot.com. And she writes, "Our family only had Penny for a month when she got lost in High Park on Sunday, December 7th at 2 p.m. We know she was hit by a car that night at 7 p.m. on Bloor Street West at High Park Avenue, but she kept running and we were told she didn't seem badly hurt, and we have not heard anything since that night. Penny is a Louisiana hurricane survivor and lived through both Hurricane Gustav and Hurricane Ike and has been stray for most of her life. We hope someone has her in their home. We need to bring her home safely. The devastation that her loss has brought our family is widespread and indescribable. She's a 35-pound spayed female, 11 months old. She looks like a pointer, Labrador, hound cross, and is very skinny. She has a white dappled coat with large apricot-colored patches with a white spot on top of her head. She has large floppy ears that are solid apricot color. She is very timid and frightens easily. She was wearing a jacket when she was lost. It was black with silver reflective lines. If she is still outside, she is likely hiding in a garage, backyard, or anywhere warm somewhere in the area. This family has gone to quite amazing lengths to try and get Penny home, so we're hoping that somebody out there might have more information for her. It's a $1,000 reward, and again, you can find more information at findpenny.blogspot.com. And without further ado, we'll get to the interview with Jody Castrocano. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. If you have any questions or comments about this show or any of our other shows, please do get in touch with us. You can find us online at www.animalvoices.ca, or you can email us at animalvoices@gmail.com. And now, Lauren's interview with Jody Castrocano.
Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I am your host, Lauren Corman, here with Carl Orzechowski. He's teching for us today. We're doing a pre-recorded show, and I'm just delighted that we have our current guest in studio. We are speaking today with Jody Castrocano, who's an associate professor in the Faculty of Creative and Critical Studies at the University of British Columbia, Okanagan. And we're talking today about her new book. It's an edited collection called Animal Subjects, an Ethical Reader in a Post-Human World. A very warm welcome on a cold day to you, Jody.
Thank you, Lauren. I really have been looking forward to this. As I said to you when we were corresponding, I find it just really generous of you guys to invite me here so that we can just have a little bit more of a a conversation about this topic, because I find that sometimes it gets either totally public or else it gets lost in the academy. And I find that the radio is a really good medium for just having people listen to what's going on out there.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the book, Animal Subjects, An Ethical Reader in a Post-Human World. What does this mean for the average listener tuning in? How would you summarize this book?
You would start with that question. It's a huge one. I think I'd like to start just by, first of all, telling how it came about, and then to see where it might come in with the average reader, because so much of it becomes a personal issue as well as a professional one. Because I think that often people's professional fields are determined by things that move them personally. At least I would hope so. So for me, it begins way back in 1984 when I was an undergraduate at SFU, and I was doing work in biology and kinesiology, and we were called upon to, as I discuss in the book, we were called upon to do dissections of animals. And I had already been a bit uncomfortable, just because I think I just had an innate sense of what it was I was going to be doing. And I was feeling not good about it. And at the time, I also happened to see that there was an animal rights club in the university, and being a second year student, was drawn to it because I wanted to know what animal rights actually meant. And so I went, and they showed a film. I think it's now available at PETA. It's called The Animals. And it just took me through a horror show of what it means to be an animal in a world in which we use them and we treat them as property. We use them for, experiments. We want to see if our, makeup is good enough, or or the products that we use, or the warfare that we have. It just seemed to cover just about everything. And so it was actually from that day on that I decided that I was, first of all, going to become a vegetarian, and second of all, that I was just going to find out what this meant. And it was not a very popular thing to do or to be in 1984, in almost like a sort of Orwellian year. But I also see it as a shift, because at least when we went to tell the professor we weren't going to do any kinds of experimentation, that, or we were, sorry, we were not going to do the dissection, that he said he didn't really agree with us, but that he would take our position into consideration, because he felt like at least we had the wherewithal to question. So he found us something else to do for the final exam, but I went on, of course, to be a vegetarian ever since then. And by the beginning, or the inception of the idea for this book, which was, say, I think it was about 4 years ago now, I was on sabbatical while I was teaching at Wilfrid Laurier in Ontario. And I got into conversations with Rod Preece, who's one of the contributors to the book, and he and I became sort of lunch friends, and going and talking about issues regarding animals and the way that we currently use them as a means to our ends. And I did a little bit even further research, and then started even thinking about becoming vegan, because I realized, even though I was in Ontario, driving back and forth and seeing these dairy farms, that we were also thinking about, there was the veal industry right before our eyes, and that depended on the dairy farms. So that really kind of was yet another level, if you will. And I think that sometimes you come to these things increasingly through going through different levels of awareness and mindfulness about what it is you're actually doing in the world. So I started to think, it was a November day. It's starting to sound like Mary Shelley's novel, but it was a November day in Ontario, and it was pouring rain. It was really horrible. And I was sitting in my office, and like I said, I was on sabbatical, but I thought, I'm going to do this because I can't find any information in Canada. Like, I can't find a place, a collection of essays or articles or anything by scholars addressing this issue. And I know I'm not the only one. So there's Rod. And so I sent out a call for papers and explaining to people. And it was kind of interesting, because many people decided that they were going to email me back to find out exactly what was my ethical stance on this and why was I asking. And I thought that was a really valid question, because they wanted to know really where I was coming from and what was the purpose of this book. And in a way, whenever I end up talking about the book, I am always so very conscious, when this show is called Animal Voices, but of all the voices that went into the making of this book and for whom I'm now speaking. And that I feel hyper responsible about that, because there are so many ways of looking at this. As Wallace Stevens says, there's so many ways of looking at a blackbird, but I see and hear everything that goes into this book, and yet I'm the one whose voice is representing it. So in a way, it's analogous to what it is you do with your show and what it is we have to do sometime when we're talking about voice and speaking for those who don't have the voice necessarily, but at the same time, you have to be very mindful of what it is you're speaking, because mm-hmm. you're also that kind of intervention can also be about shifts of power.
Exactly, yeah.
So that's how it came about, and I now almost forget your first question.
Well, I was gonna say, how would you summarize the book? And I know that one of the ways that you've talked about and you write about the book is that being an intervention into cultural studies.
Right, okay. I think that cultural studies and critical theory have always aimed at critiquing a model of universal human commonality. There's always been this sense for a couple of hundred years at least that the human is a category or a species that goes without saying, that we can take for granted that it's all about nature, and really, when it gets down to it, the human has nothing to do with culture. Yet what cultural studies has done in terms of an intervention into that idea, and I'll come around to that again when I'm talking about post-humanism, but cultural studies has been really vigilant and thinking about issues of racism and sexism and classism and ageism. And there are all of these isms that demonstrate their arbitrariness within culture, that are also issues of power and who gets to have a voice.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, historically speaking, the human has always been a Western European Caucasian male, you know, and we're talking issues of authority. And I mean, these, you know, go back quite a long ways to really theological patristic times. But consequently, cultural studies I've seen as being an intervention into looking at the power politics of identity and what enables authoritative voices. And when it comes to the human, what we've learned, or at least if we're paying attention, is that the human has been a category that has relied heavily on another category that's not usually thought of, and that's what isn't human. So it gains its identity from everything that it excludes. At one time, it could have been slaves, because slaves were not considered to be human. It could have been women, because, well, pretty well women weren't considered human, but they sure weren't until the last century in Canada even considered persons. It was that famous persons case in the 1920s. In which women challenged the fact that they were not considered in the British North America Act as persons. So, you know, and we have rather short memories when we start to understand the arbitrariness of these kinds of categories. So when we think about feminist issues or queer issues or issues regarding racism or any kind of ism like that, we start to realize how they are posed or poised historically, in that they exclude others. And really, I find that with cultural studies, because it has taken on this interventionist politics in terms of interdisciplinarity and calling into question all of the kinds of borders that determine identity or determine power or authority, that the one category that always remains excluded mm-hmm. in order that we can still talk about these things is that of the animal or the non-human animal, because still to be human means not to be one of mm-hmm. those. And I mean, this has really been, I think, brought forward in a lot of the work by the people in this particular volume, people like Rod Preece, people like Carrie Wolf, Donna Haraway in particular. These are all people who have actually been questioning that border that has maintained a certain kind of identity within a capitalist system, and where we're talking about, we're really talking about a kind of military-industrial complex in which those sorts of relationships often depend on all of those who get excluded. So to intervene in cultural studies, for me, which is this field that has a lot of potential and has done a lot of great cultural work in not only in just thinking about equalities, but in actually calling into question those kinds of ideological assumptions that people have that go without saying, that really determine, again, those sorts of power situations, if you will, who has any rights. You know, when you think about determinations and categories and the way that we define things, language itself tells us the problem. If we even look today at the say, in the last 5 to 10 years, the debates regarding what constitutes a family.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we start to see, again, if we're sort of ideologically mindful, that there's a great interest and in what some critics would call compulsory heterosexuality that goes into determining family. Well, that's a word, that's a container almost for these struggles, power struggles. So the category of the animal, and I'm not talking about animals out there and all of the ones for whom this is about, but that category itself has sustained the non-question for cultural studies. It's a kind of area of silence. It's a vacuum. It's sort of a...
I want to call it the elephant in the room.
Yeah, totally. That's it. That's perfect. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad to hear you mention in your description about the consequences of this ideology for people. For example, you mentioned slaves, you mentioned women, because I think sometimes in these discussions about what it means to be a human, the relevance of humanism, that it can sound very abstract, but this is actually very key to having real, it's had real negative consequences. These ideologies play out in a material world, and that means a lot of suffering, a lot of violence, etc., that this ideology is in many ways the fuel or it drives things like torture, unjust killing, etc., etc. So when we're talking about cultural studies and what it's trying to do in terms of an intervention, these are extremely important philosophical, ideological questions, because they really do make a difference into how people treat each other, think of the world, think of other animals, and then that has other consequences as well.
You know, this is so bang on, because when we talk about thinking about the world, and even if it sounds abstract, we can talk about paradigms in which the view of reality is all about all of these various discourses, the kind that disappear into our understanding of what constitutes the social and the cultural and ourselves and others. So in this context, when we think about suffering, this is another issue that has come up, because it's from, you know, it goes back even further than Descartes. But I mean, Descartes was the one who said, well, when animals are suffering, when we do vivisection on them, when we hear their sounds they make, those are just the sounds of machines. They don't understand that they suffer, therefore they don't have the same value. Now, I mean, we're certainly talking about the way that the rational subject is perceived and the consequences of what that might mean for people in terms of their ability to have empathy, to have compassion, to understand what violence is all about. We can go from representational violence all the way down to physical violence and killing, and the way that animals are treated in factory farming and transport and in, you know, just to make possible the multitude of products that we buy. I mean, it's shocking. And I think the thing that really it brings it home down to on the pragmatic level are the choices that people have to make in order that they not participate in the suffering, because there's a lot of things that people aren't willing to give up. And this has always been a kind of an eye-opener to me in seeing when people can be outraged about an issue, mm-hmm. and then suddenly it's incumbent upon them to do something that is different about their own lives, and that can easily just sort of dissipate. I was at a conference here in Toronto a couple of years ago, the Nature Matters conference, and I was so intrigued by what was going on at the conference. And one of the things that I wanted to talk about there was about 100 years ago, Albert Schweitzer had said something to the effect of, you know, in 100 years, we should understand what's at stake when we're talking about violence and unnecessary violence. And then at the same conference, and I was quoting Kerry Wolfe, who was saying that in 100 years from now, we then might start to see what it is we're doing in terms of violence to non-human animals and how that might be an analogy between what happened in concentration camps and towards a certain group of people who are singled out and what that means for them. And of course, I mean, there's a lot of people that don't like that analogy, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of thinkers who say this is exactly where we have to start thinking about it. You know, what that kind of thing means. So my question around the conference is, okay, that was 100 years ago, and we're talking about 100 years from now. What do we do right now in the thing we call now? Mm-hmm. And all of these nows that accompany us become really integral to the kind of life we can live, what it means to actually make choices about being human in relationship to others. And those others are the ones with whom we share this planet. And they may not be able to speak, but we can certainly make choices about them. And those choices are predicated upon not how intelligent they are, or how strong they are, or how soulful they are, but just the fact of their being, in the sense of sharing and interrelationship. I mean, we talked once about what might constitute empathy. And the issue of empathy is myriad. I mean, empathy is not predictable, and sometimes in a way it's very difficult to define because it's an experience, and we can talk about it abstractly, but if you've ever had it, you certainly know what it means. Mm-hmm. And if you look at what constitutes suffering and understand that suffering is, you know, because let me just step back one step here, but you know, it was once thought that slaves didn't suffer because they didn't have the constitution of the Western Europeans. So they were one rung down. And of course, this is the same argument, really, that's being applied to non-human animals, is that, well, basically, you know, they're all the same and they don't have a culture and they don't have consciousness. And the issue of what we extend to them in terms of compassion is, I think, severely limited by the attitude, the prevailing attitude that we have, that sometimes it makes things easier for us not to know. Because, you know and to not do anything becomes, I think it's a really dangerous place, because you become, even if you are unconscious and somebody tells you that this is the case, that across the street from you, this is happening with animals, with, you know, children, all of those for whom, you know, they become voiceless in a sense, and you do nothing. Well, I think, I mean, I don't even know, I can, I get kind of, I feel speechless. Mm-hmm. I feel the same sort of speechlessness myself when I, as a PETA member, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, when I, as a member, I get information from PETA about dog fighting or factory farming, in which, you know, the people who work on factory farms themselves are disenfranchised, and who take that out on the animals that they're processing, and the kinds of cruelty that happen there. I mean, whoever, first of all, A, would want that to be in their food is one story, but B, I mean, these are the horror stories of our modern life.
Mm-hmm.
What factory farming has enabled. I mean, if you don't care about the animals, then you got to at least pay attention to what's happening to the environment. You have to pay attention to the fact that the animals are, you know, being pumped full of antibiotics and hormones, and what that might mean to you. But so there are, as I said, various rings of understanding that get you closer and closer to the actual fact, which would be the horror
mm-hmm.
of it. And advertising doesn't want you to know that. That's why they show happy cows. And I mean, I don't even want to sit here and describe to you, because I know you know, but it's like when I get stuff from PETA or World, you know, the Animal Alliance, it's almost like, I know this. I can't really look at it because I already know.
Mm-hmm. So, it demands something from you, I think, in a way.
Yeah. And I mean, I think I've already sort of ponied up to the demand in the sense of doing what I can do thus far. And when I see these, I almost can feel emotionally overwhelmed. And so I have to stop and say to myself, well, okay, you know, you're one person, you do one thing. But if everybody does that one thing and just becomes a little bit mindful, I think that it's an amazing thing that we can do. I'm hoping to teach a course at UBC on the question of the animal. And I'm both looking forward to it, but I'm also a bit nervous about doing it, because I think this is a topic that is so close.
I think it's tough.
It is. I know you have you've done some teaching.
Yeah, I did an animal. The way I framed the class, and the reason why what you're saying in this book, The Animal Subjects, An Ethical Reader in a Post-Human World, is so important to me, is because the whole course was framed as bringing the animal question into cultural studies.
Yeah.
And I did it in the context of class on environmental studies, but talking about post-colonialism and talking about anti-racist theory and trying to look at those links. And those are already hard topics. To really talk about white privilege mm-hmm. is hard for a lot of people. It's certainly hard for me to struggle with that and think about privilege. And then you're adding a new layer. And animals in particular is such an emotional topic for people in general. And to be implicated that way and into widespread suffering, I think is really quite intense. But on the other hand, the flip side of teaching that is that people are engaged
yeah.
and everyone is there.
What was the response you got?
Well, I can talk about that, but I think we need to take a break. We'll take a short break, and then I'll come back and talk a little bit about
okay.
my teaching experiences, and then we'll talk more about the book.
Okay.
You are listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. It's my great pleasure to have in studio today Jody Castricano, and we're talking about a lot of different topics, cultural studies in particular, and this book, Animal Subjects, An Ethical Reader in a Post-Human World, which is an intervention into cultural studies in many ways. Take a short break. We'll come back. Please stay tuned. Hello, and welcome back to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. Today we're joined in studio with Jody Castricano. She is an associate professor in the Faculty of Creative and Critical Studies at the University of British Columbia, Okanagan. We're talking today about a new text, an edited collection by Jody, called Animal Subjects, An Ethical Reader in a Post-Human World. And before the break, Jody was asking me about some of my experiences teaching, because as I was saying, I was really excited about this book because I think I could have used this as my central text in the class in terms of what I was trying to do to bring in questions around gender, around race, ethnicity, and to try to put them in conversation with animals and to show how this question of exclusion, it relates both to how we've excluded and oppressed humans as well, and it's linked with, although it's not the same, with how we've treated and thought of animals. So this is so delightful to me to actually see this collection, although it's a couple years too late in terms of my class that I was teaching. But I was going to reflect a little bit on on that experience, which was such an amazing experience, because my own struggles in the academy in terms of coming from women's studies and then going into environmental studies, very rich, politically charged places that were very dedicated, that are very dedicated to creating social and political change, to feel such an allegiance to the people, my colleagues, but at the same time incredibly alienated because that silence around animals and trying to figure out what is it about some of the paradigms that we're using that do not allow me to ask sophisticated questions about animals. And I think that part of what I've tried to do with the radio show is to bring together scholars and activists who have somehow made space for thinking about animals in this more, that it's not just about their treatment. We, of course, we need to treat animals better, but how did we get here and what are the ideologies that inform our treatment? To ask them not necessarily in an academic way, but to ask them in a way that gets beyond, let's just treat Sam the dog better. Although, of course, let's treat Sam the dog better.
Anyway.
But the frameworks around environmental studies and my background in feminist theory, my starting point was with professors who said, all oppressions are linked. You cannot theorize who a woman is without talking about that intersectionality with racism, with gender, with sexuality, etc. So I was looking at vivisection at the time, and I was looking at factory farming, and I was thinking, this is clearly an example of oppression. I will just go to feminist theory, and it will help illuminate this, because I'm trying to figure out how the hell did we get here? Because feminist theory was this incredible place of both kind of self-interrogation, a real kind of turning myself inside out, very painful, but also an incredible set of ideas that made me feel empowered. And I thought, well, it's done all this amazing work, surely it can illuminate the question of the animal. And I think to some degree it has. There have been certainly feminist theorists, a lot of feminist theorists that have taken up the question of the animal, but there's a lot that haven't. And I was thinking, well, why would that be? Why is there that silence? And so then transitioning to environmental studies, where there's maybe a richer tradition of theorizing the non-human, and then seeing again a silence around particular animals, or that we could only theorize wild animals as being relevant. And so I remember laughing when I was very sort of just the beginning of my environmental studies degree, my master's program, well, I'm here because I can't do animal studies, as if that was just the most ridiculous thing to think about, that there could be something called animal studies. Mm-hmm. You know, and then here I am now, 2009, a collection like this exists. There's all sorts of animal studies classes that are going to be taught. You were talking about teaching class. It's a really exciting time because it seems like people are creating a space for more sophisticated questions around animals. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain legitimizing that's happening within the academy that I think is very powerful.
It's very slow. I think it's also has it. It's reminiscent of the ways that feminism and gender studies came into the academy. You know, what we see is the, for example, things like earlier on in Shakespeare classes, women wanted to do feminist readings, and there were professors who were saying, well, there was no feminism when Shakespeare was writing, therefore you can't do a feminist reading because it's invalid and it's, you know, it doesn't make any sense. You know, when people then were talking about sentience and animals and oppressions and the linking of oppressions, I think that it's a very thin edge of the wedge, and it's starting to permeate what we do in terms of cultural studies, what we do especially in terms of literary studies, because I think that this is where a lot of animal studies began, in the sense of coming forward and finding a legitimate place in the university, because people were, there was as far back as when I was an MA student at SFU, there was Miriam Schultmeier wrote a book on animals in literature, and that was, you know, like almost 20 years ago, 15 years ago, but nobody paid much attention to it. I remember her giving a presentation on it, and it was kind of like, well, yeah, she's talking about animals, but you know, we want to talk about literature, and that's much more important. But the point is that it's just a slow dawning of consciousness about what it is we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you or I will ever live to see the paradigm shift that's necessary in the world that might be akin to, you know, changing from a heliocentric, you know, model of the universe in which suddenly the world looks different because we see it differently, because we see that we actually have interaction instead of, you know, we're not these isolated individuals that that humanism would have seen us as, in which, you know, we have we're sort of much more monadic in the sense of closed circuits. Instead, what we're looking at with eco-feminism, with eco-criticism, with the deep ecology movements, with feminism, and now with animal studies, we're talking about interconnections. And I just want to do a little sidebar here, but to my mind, this has very much to do with indigenous studies and the way that indigeneity has taken a different model of what the universe is about and people's relationship to nature, the thing we call nature. Mm-hmm. We don't have time anyway. And what I mean by that is, and I'm not romanticizing this, but I want to think through it in the way that one branch of Western science has now coincided with indigenous studies. And that branch of Western science was promulgated by people like Carl Jung and Wolfgang Pauli, the physicist, when they talked about quantum theory and that relationship that one has with matter, psyche matter. Things matter, in other words, and that we are less alone than we ever thought, because we're talking about a vast web of interconnectivity. Now, some people hear that in spiritual terms. Other people hear that in social terms. But what we know is that just like a spider hits her web, you know, there's a vibration that goes through. And we start to understand that one action that one has its effects all over the place. So, you know, when you find yourself not going to the meat counter and saying, okay, I'm not going to do that, I'm not participating in that anymore, I'm not going to buy milk because I know what's at stake, because there are veal calves going to restaurants, and, you know, and the veal industry is so, I'm sorry, I'm just going to say this, it's so evil that, you know, if you make those choices, if you make those choices, you then start to recognize that interconnectivity, which in my way of thinking is the basis of empathy. And then, you know, when you get into a classroom with a bunch of people and start to have this conversation with the intention of not necessarily teaching a subject, but opening the subject, mm-hmm. and making that subject accessible in terms of people being able, students and professors, teachers, being able to understand that affect has a place in the production of knowledge. Because historically, the university is this place of intellectual rigor and research and all of that, but nobody ever talks, unless you're in psychology and you're doing tests, but about what is the role of affect when we're learning something. I mean, if you have a feeling about it, if you have an emotional response to something, you're going to remember it. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have it be part of what it is you think you know about the world and yourself. So consequently, when I'm, you know, I've been introducing a lot of material in the form of novels into my classes, like in the 19th century, you know, things like The Island of Dr. Moreau, which is this sort of nightmarish treatment of vivisection and what it means to be human. You know, it's a sort of Blade Runner version, if you will, of the issue regarding pain, suffering, and empathy. So I introduce that, and then I've noticed that I'll say to the students, okay, well, now I would just like to read to you some passages from some newspapers that came out in the 19th century that were anti-vivisectionist, in which they give descriptions over animals being subject to this. And students will almost an individual one raise their hands or put their hands over their ears. And I said, okay, look, just tell me, what is it you're hearing? What is it that you want me to stop reading? Why? because that should be part of what it is we're doing. That to me is like one of those moments, and it's very hard to, for them to articulate in the sense, because I mean, when I mentioned in the book about coming across an image of a cow being put through a processing plant, I mean, those words are so sterile anyway, but you know, I mean, it raises something in me that I say in the book, it's unspeakable, and mm-hmm. there are these unspeakable moments, but experientially they're very powerful. And I think if students or listeners or anybody reading, and you find yourself not wanting to hear, that's a moment in which you have the opportunity to learn something.
Yeah, I think that the points that you're raising about empathy and the academy and the place of teaching around affect and what does that mean, they're all, it's just such a dangerous, mm-hmm. because I think people see it as this, it's, I'm going to use a whole series of cliches, it opens up a door, it's a slippery slope, we give ourselves over to feeling, then suddenly the tools for rigorous intellectual evaluation go out the window. You can feel however you want to feel, and that's how you get evaluated in the class. Do you feel right about animals? Are you empathetic enough? How do you respond then to people who say, well, this isn't the place, the academy isn't the place for that empathetic turn, because that's not what we do here. We're dedicated to rational thought, and it gives us tools that are more objective, and we kind of can't just give ourselves over to just feeling nice about animals. I'm really being, I know, I'm
no,
being
I know,
really
I know, I know
devil's advocate in
I know
this,
what you're doing, but actually, I mean, it's funny, all of the things that you're saying in a way, because when you say, first of all, you know, we're not being objective, I think we have to look at the objectivity as a myth. It's one of the great myths of culture in itself, because what it presumes is that, you know, there is a radical disconnect. And that radical disconnect is the very thing that gets us into this position in the first place. Secondly, I mean, one of the examples that come to mind when we say that affect has no place in the classroom, I mean, literary studies, for one thing, is certainly evidence against that, because, you know, how do we respond to cultural texts in terms of novels, films, documentaries? All of those things are not just about taking an objective approach to them. And if you go and you look at teaching evaluation forms, I always find those a really interesting study in what the university as an institution is about, because one of the questions they will ask students is, do you feel the instructor is caring of student concerns?
Sensitive to students' needs. I was just looking at mine. Yeah.
And so they're asking students to respond to their instructors on this level. Yet at the same time, I think that anybody who is really rigorous about trying to keep affect out of the classroom is giving us only sort of one half of the equation with regards to what constitutes knowledge. Mm-hmm. So it's that same categorization, that sort of taxonomy that suggests, okay, everything that belongs in here is the real thing. It's the thing that we give grant authority to. But, I mean, if you start to realize the arbitrariness of all of that, I mean, you know, where would we be? If we were 100 years ago today, neither of us as women would be sitting here in a university. We wouldn't even be able to take university classes. I mean, this was the whole thing that Virginia Woolf was talking about, in a room of one's own. Women were excluded from the university. It wasn't even natural for them to want to have that kind of knowledge. It wasn't useful, of course. Mm-hmm. So I'm just saying that if we think even historically, then we can argue just against particular kinds of pedagogical models and the things that constitute what it is, you know, a degree is about. Mm-hmm. What is it worth? Mm-hmm. What is it worth to you if you end up, you know, at the other end of it and you haven't thought a thing that scared you? Mm-hmm. You haven't thought a thing that even insulted you. You know, you could consider yourself lucky to have that moment.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I hear you too talk about these issues and the interconnections, I think for people who are coming from a more traditional perspective in the academy, mm-hmm. you are just, I'm imagining a series of spheres, and you are going more and more and more marginal. She wants to talk about women, and she wants to talk about queer issues. And so your art, and then you're saying, and I want to talk about in terms of animals now, and then I want to talk about affect and empathy. Ooh, she is out there. Mm-hmm. Is it? Do you ever have that desire to try to use the tools? I know that they're reinforcing tools, but to use the tools that traditionally have said these are important topics to bring animals in. So let's do quantitative research that mm-hmm. shows animals are important, or let's use some of those discourses that are more traditional, conventional, as a way of legitimating animals as topics.
I mean, the fact that we are sitting here having this conversation with this book between us demonstrates that, yes, you know, there, all of that quantitative, qualitative, because there are some, there is a quantitative researcher who has an essay in the book, Anne Dagg, talks about, you know, wastefulness in terms of animal experimentation, and the way that really, if you start to look through the journals and the kinds of things that are published, that what you see is that really many researchers just don't want to give up the lucrative research funding when we have to consider some of these questions. And so she has herself gone through in this quantitative way and extrapolated from that. And but she has taken that, because we all know that any kind of quantitative research, when we have a lot of facts before us, that what we can do is use them in certain ways. So I guess what's important to me is always to think about history. It's always to think about power and knowledge in this way that Michel Foucault would have us think about. It's always to think about discursive, that is to say, the many kinds of, I'm trying to sort of sum up what I mean by discursivity in the sense of the sociological, medical, psychological, philosophical ways of talking about something, how they all sort of adhere to give us a picture of our world. So, to my mind, to develop critical thinking about that is to be able to ask questions. And this is not to say that I privilege affect over critical approaches or rational approaches, but that I don't see them as being separate. I see them as, in fact, as working together, because in order to take a critical approach, you know, you have to be very, first of all, develop a critical ear. It's like Derrida says, when you are in the university, you know, it's almost like you can develop a huge Kafka-esque ear in which, you know, it gets attuned. But on the personal level, you have to be mindful of what it is your ear is listening to. Because there's so many ears in the university. Mm-hmm. And so what we end up doing is inscribing a whole lot of voices. So when we speak of those voices critically, then we have to be able to evaluate them. And that doesn't necessarily exclude affect, but what it does do is it teaches us that in an arbitrary society, in an arbitrary culture, we can ask questions that are really probing questions, and they might leave us confused, but that confusion can be a really valuable thing, because it will lead us to the door of asking about how it is we're treating animals and what that will mean for them.
I wanted to talk, as we're very quickly winding down the interview, which is so unfortunate because I feel like we just started.
Me too.
I wanted to go back to the book, Animal Subjects, an Ethical Reader in a Post-Human World. And I wanted to talk about the book in relationship to some of the things that you had been speaking about in terms of empathy. And before we got into the studio, you said the book tells a narrative. And one of the themes, it seems, of the book then is empathy. And I'm wondering if you can flesh out for us the narrative of the book and maybe how it raises questions around empathy through its telling.
Okay. When I initially sent out the call for papers for the book, I didn't explicitly mention empathy or compassion. But overwhelmingly, almost all of the essays I got, in one way or another, addressed that issue, brought it in other words, talked about it, that we have to take an intellectual journey here, but unapologetically we will be inclusive. We will include empathy. And so as I was putting it together, I started to look at the composition of the essays and, you know, went through them all and realized, of course, that in editing a book, what one does is you have to order, decide what order your essays are going to be in. And so I saw the ordering of them as a narrative in itself. So I began, if I could actually just go through a couple of them, just to, in the sense of looking at how it went, because it began with the Donna Haraway essay. And, of course, everybody knows about, well, most people know, rather, about Donna Haraway and how ironic she could be. And I actually got a lot of flack for Donna Haraway's essay because I heard from readers that maybe it didn't really... Well, first of all, can I just take one step back? I was told to begin with that this book did not belong in cultural studies. It took a long time for its publication because the press had to send it out to another reader. This one reader objected vociferously that this was not a cultural studies topic. And I thought, but that's my point. That is the point of the whole book. And so I became even more convinced that it needed to be in cultural studies, because what we are doing insofar as cultural studies being this vast field of all of these discourses coming together to address questions of, as you say, critical race theory, you know, queer, all of that, that the putting together of the narrative might have a place in here as well, which was one of the reasons I picked Donna Haraway's very generous submission of Chicken, because I thought, in a way, this is kind of playing chicken with cultural studies, because it's bringing it into the arena, first of all, and demonstrating that the very thing that people think about as far as animals are concerned, that, you know, the fable itself is central. So Donna Haraway is saying in Chicken, you know, when Chicken says the sky is falling, that actually what we have to do is pay attention to those voices that we discredit, those kind of Cassandra-like voices in which they're giving warnings not only of what happens in factory farming, but to workers, all of that. So I thought her irony was really important here, because it did, as irony always does, a kind of double job. It says that there's a couple of things going on. So the book itself seemed to me to be multiple, rather like throwing mercury on a floor, and it just spreads out all over the place. So then I went into that and saw that Rod Preece's essay on selfish genes, sociobiology, and animal respect had very much to do with the model of a kind of an abstract model, evolutionary model of the way that if we have compassion, somehow it doesn't really make sense in terms of survival. And Rod Preece, you know, really objected to that, saying that what this does do is it really devalues the very thing that we need to rethink in terms of humanity and our relationship to animals. So, and I'm suddenly very aware of the time, and I can't go through all of these essays to tell you the whole thing about the narrative, except to say that then the second essay, which was had to do with Descartes, it was by Don McCants, and it really demonstrated the way that the animal became configured through Descartes and through vivisection as far as this kind of machine quality to it. And Carrie Wolf picks up on this too as well. But I included together an essay by Paolo Cavalieri. Mm-hmm. She's a wonderful Italian theorist, and I first came across her book called The Animal Question, and with Carrie Wolf's, because the two of them have different perspectives on Derrida's take on animals. Paolo Cavalieri says that, you know, really somehow European philosophy has failed us when it comes to vegetarianism, and really what it the configuration of animals within philosophy, whereas Wolf says, no, with deconstruction, this leads us to the edge of calling into question all of those categories that have sustained a particular model. Anyway, we go on. We have Animals in Moral Space, and by Michael Allen Fox and Leslie McLean, and an article by Angus Taylor. And they get us into thinking about literature and the way that literature itself is productive of empathy and enables us to explore subjectivity in ways that we might not do in so far as other ways. And John Sorensen's essay is brilliant. I mean, it's
devastating.
Yeah, it's really incredible, just about marine land and the way that we can one should always be suspicious when one says we, right? But the constitution of animals as objects there for our enjoyment. You know, they're somehow to be used, and we just look at them as if they're chairs. And, I mean, it just goes on like this. And it ends with a couple of... There's Leslie Bisgold's essay, and she's a lawyer in Toronto, and she does a lot of work on... she worked with Clayton Ruby with the Kensington case. And hers is, of course, the whole issue of animals as property and the fact that the law came down on those students, not because of what they had done to the animals, but because the animals were property.
Yeah.
So that... you know, really has to be rethought. And then there's Ann Dagg's on animal experimentation. I've already referred to that. And finally, Joanna Tito's on animal immortality. And she brings in the, you know, sort of spiritual dimension. So I thought it went from irony to cultural theory into literary issues. There's an article here on Mary Wollstonecraft, who was very central to issues of thinking about compassion for animals. And I guess I'm trying to sum up 5 years' work in about 2 minutes. And like I just hope that I have done all of the contributors justice here, because it wouldn't have happened without them.
It's a phenomenal collection. I've been... You know, I don't consider myself an expert, but I've been certainly studying these intersections for about a decade now, and I learned a lot.
I'm glad.
Yeah, I really appreciated this text. I think it would be great for people who are interested in all those questions around racism, sexism, etc., and then have an interest in animals. Or maybe if you don't, maybe this is exactly the book to read too.
Exactly. And I think that it enables people to go from... There's a lot of the essays that are very accessible, and there are some that are a little bit more abstract.
Right.
So,
well, thanks so much for being in studio today.
Thank you.
It was a great pleasure.
You. Mine
and,
too.
And I just adore the book, and I'm so glad that it's out there in the world doing what it does. So today we were joined in studio with Jody Castricano, and we were talking about a new collection called Animal Subjects, an Ethical Reader in a Post-Human World. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. Dos Mundos coming up.